One of the things that I think the people who are out there frolicking need to realize that when you do that and you see no negative effect in 1 week, please don't be overconfident, because the effect of spreading is not going to be seen for 2, 3, and maybe even more weeks. And at that time, you could have the uptick. And that's the reason why we encourage people, as we want people to be able to have the opportunity to reopen, to be prudent and take a careful look at the guidelines, yep, and to the best extent possible to follow them.
Dr. Anthony Fauci on CNN yesterday. LA County is slowly starting to open back up, allowing some in-store shopping and religious services to resume with restrictions on how many people can be in one place at one time. It's opening slower than the rest of the state, since it is, after all, the epicenter of California's outbreak. But there's growing concern in the county and in the state that our reopening, limited as it is happening too fast. LA County added more than 900 coronavirus cases yesterday. Another 53 people lost their lives. But experts still say the true number of cases is likely much higher than the official numbers. Barbara Ferrer is the director of the LA County Department of Public Health. She joins me now. Welcome.
Hi. Well, thanks so much for having me, Madeline.
Well, it's great to have you back. What data are you looking at that tells you, yes, indeed, LA County is ready to open up?
You know, we look very carefully at a lot of different metrics, but I will say the two or three that are critically important for us to pay attention to is what's happening in our hospitals. So we look a lot at sort of the daily hospitalization rate, and embedded in that is, of course, paying attention to the percent of people in the intensive care units and the percent of people that need to be using ventilators. And that number for LA County has been steadily declining. I think we're down about like 16% from where we were even a week and a half ago. Today I believe we have about slightly under 1,500 people in the hospital. If folks remember, a couple of weeks ago, we were much closer to 1,900 on a regular basis. So we've seen a steady decline in the number of people who are positive for COVID-19 who are being hospitalized. Another number that I watch, and this is for me the most tragic number that we both report, but we do have to pay attention to, is how many people are dying every day and who mm-hmm. are the people who are dying. We here, too, have seen a significant decline. I don't think it's the kind of decline we should be bragging about, although we still have lots of people who are dying every day. Deaths are particularly down in our skilled nursing facilities. And I love that Dr. Fauci pointed out that, you know, unfortunately, with this virus, the steps you take today, you often don't get to see the impact of those steps for a few weeks. And I think, in fact, that's the case in the skilled nursing facilities. The steps we took 3 and 4 weeks ago are hopefully leading to a sustainable decline in both new cases and in people who are passing away, who are residing in the nursing homes, as well as employees, because mm-hmm. we've had a significant number of our healthcare worker deaths among the workers in our nursing homes. You know, I want to say that's been a combination of a couple of things. You know, once we really zoned in on the fact that asymptomatic spread was happening and was, in fact, happening a lot, particularly in institutional settings. You know, the first thing that happened is everybody was ordered to wear a surgical mask all of the time. And that included residents who can tolerate those masks. And, you know, also, as you know, we've been really trying to make sure we can get in as quickly as possible and get everybody tested so we can find out who is asymptomatic.
Yeah. Let me ask you about testing, because the World Health Organization says about 10% need to be testing positive, or less than 10%, in order to get a handle on this disease. What is the rate of positive tests here in LA County?
You know, we're down to 8%. If you were just looking at our recent numbers, it's down even lower. So the positivity rate, again, I know, you know, you've been with me since the beginning. So mm-hmm. you know, at the beginning, it was closer to 15%. And that too has dropped to 8%. People often, like to look at sort of cases and say, well, cases are going up, and that's what we really should be looking at. And the case numbers are mixed in terms of the stories that they tell. One story they tell is that testing is more available and more people are able to get tested. And, that's a good news story for me. And, I really thank our colleagues at the Department of Health Services for really ramping up testing. We're over 15,000 tests a day now here in L.A. County. Our partners in the city have been doing amazing work. And that's good because, we have to identify people who are positive. And one of the only ways to do that is actually to test people.
What is the goal if you have 15,000 a day? But what is the goal for testing per day?
Well, the goal for now was to get to 15,000. I mean, that was a standard that the state has asked us to reach in order to apply for a variance. To open up at an accelerated pace. If we were to become a variance county, we had to meet that threshold. And I think that's a reasonable threshold. I think you need to have access to testing for the people who absolutely need to be tested. And, those priority lists have, again, changed over time as we understand more about the virus. But that really includes, our healthcare workers, folks who are in an outbreak situation, close contacts in those situations also now need to get tested. Symptomatic people, particularly symptomatic people in high-risk categories, need to be able to get testing easily. And I am so grateful that, that has been prioritized by the Board of Supervisors, by the mayors, and so we've opened up that capacity. At the end of the day, that capacity also has to sit squarely within our provider networks as well. It's good in the short run to have a lot of, mobile test sites, but in the long run, since this virus is going to be with us for months, we really need to build capacity at our federally qualified health centers, within our provider groups. Our hospitals are doing a great job making sure their labs are able to do this test, because the best way to get tested is in consultation with your provider. And, we do get calls from people who say, I got tested. I didn't really get any information. I'm not sure. Like, what should I be doing? Should I be isolating while I'm waiting for my results? So we like it to be, embedded in a healthcare practice. We also want people, when they get their results, to be able often to consult with their provider, particularly if they have underlying health conditions, on what steps they need to be taking. So
I spoke with an epidemiologist yesterday who was warning of another spike in the fall, maybe October, which could be worse than the current situation. He was predicting more than 100,000 additional people in the United States would die because the public health capacity is just not there. We're just not there with the testing and the tracing and the isolating. And that in the fall, there will be even less of an appetite to shelter in place. Mm-hmm. How is LA County preparing for that huge influx that not just this epidemiologist, but a lot of public health experts are predicting is going to happen?
Yeah. I think it's a really important question. And, I want to, first of all, provide a lot of reassurance on the contact tracing. We have a lot of capacity here in L.A. County for contact tracing. We have well over, I'd say 1,300 people right now that are actively doing contact tracing every single day. And we are continuing to build our capacity so that we would anticipate building capacity enough that we could handle 12,000 follow-ups a day. But we're building.
Do you think that you'll
capacity.
Be able to prevent a spike in the fall? And we just have a few more seconds here.
I'm not sure, what we can do to prevent a spike for sure. It relies on so many of us doing our part, we've been messaging that, and so have you. The importance of the reopening happening as people, really implement all the protocols that we're requiring folks to implement to create more safety. Everyone needs to be wearing their face coverings when they're around other people. Everyone needs to be keeping their distance. So, that's our job. And our job, I think you said it best, the summer is the time to prepare for the fall. and prepare for the possibility both of having a lot of influenza in our communities and a lot of COVID-19. We will do our best to work with everyone so that we're as prepared as we possibly can be, and we get a handle on those areas where we're still challenged, our institutional settings, making sure we have enough PPE. We need those supply chains. Striking, we're the richest country in the world, and every single day I worry whether or not we have enough PPE for our frontline workers. We got to fix that before we get to the fall.
Barbara Ferrer, LA County Public Health Director. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, two critics of the state's reopening, two lawmakers, one from LA, one from the Bay Area. They're here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. As county officials continue to loosen restrictions, some California politicians aren't really on board. We're joined now by two of them, Los Angeles Assemblywoman Sidney Camlogger and State Senator Steve Glaser. He represents parts of Northern California in the East Bay. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Well, Assemblywoman, I want to begin with you. We just heard Barbara Ferrer say that deaths and hospitalizations are down. LA's testing is up to the state mandated 15,000 a day. Is that not good enough to reopen?
Well, you know, first I want to say I have a lot of respect for Dr. Ferrer. I am part of the Los Angeles County delegation of assembly members and senators that represent this region, and she has met with us on occasion to talk with us about these issues, and I know she's sensitive to the needs and the residents of this county. I was, you know, cautiously optimistic listening to what she said. I think it's also important to recognize that Los Angeles County is diverse, it is dense, and it is residentially segregated. And we need to be thinking about variances within Los Angeles County and taking those variances into consideration that support the equity and the life of all of us.
So what would that mean? That would mean some businesses in some parts of the county could reopen and others could not, depending on how bad it is in those particular areas?
Well, I think it's also important to look at the data that's coming from within the county around testing and deaths across the region. So from higher income neighborhoods all the way to lower income neighborhoods, from some of the communities that are incredibly dense to those that are not so much. These are real components in how people access information, resources, services, and treatment. And I know that after April 19th, we saw a spike in the number of infection rates and deaths coming from low-income communities, East LA, South LA, and some of the smaller cities. Exponential spikes, mostly because many of those folks are frontline workers. They don't have the luxury of being able to self-isolate or quarantine at home. They have jobs that put them in the public space. They need public transportation to get where they're going. They don't have the luxury of working from home or remotely, or they're dependent on public systems and services, you know, for their freedom and survival. And those communities, our communities, my district, folks that live in my district, need to be taken in consideration when we're talking about reopening.
Well, quickly, briefly, what do you think that needs to be happening that is not happening for them in particular?
Well, making sure that we have the availability of contact tracing and more tests there. Dr. Ferrer was correct, making sure that we are shoring up our safety net services and our provider network that offers health care and access to health care. You know, we have heard continuing stories of PPE not being available at all of our community clinics. She did mention that, you know, the hospital rates are going down, but we also know that a lot of folks are afraid to go to hospitals, and that's not necessarily where they're going first off to get any treatment. And so we have to look below, you know, beneath the surface of the numbers that we were just given to talk about how we are equitably and equally going to treat the residents of this county as we're reopening.
And over to you now, Senator Glaser. What are your issues with the state reopening up in Northern California?
Well, there are, first, let me just acknowledge the same hard work, appreciation for the hard work of our public health officers and our state leaders. But unfortunately, there are some significant blind spots in the data that we have available to us that justify the reopening that is being proposed going forward. Number two, that there is a lack of concern for the elderly and those who have compromised immune systems in terms of the reopening plans. And finally, that leadership has not laid out any metrics with transparency about how an increase in infection is going to change the reopening that is, it will then be in place. And we're going to have to ratchet it back, but what standard is going to be used? So those are three key areas where I think, to me at least, this reopening is going too fast.
Right. And so you see in Sonoma County, for example, yesterday they halted reopening because their case count doubled in the past 2 weeks. Are you afraid that that could happen elsewhere?
Well, keep in mind that the case counts, hospitalization, death, those are all trailing indicators. The state and the county, for that matter, have not been able to answer three very simple questions. Number one, what is the current rate of infection? Nobody knows that. No surveys have been done and revealed to disclose the current rate of infection. Number two, there is no data that shows how it has changed over time. As we have sheltered in place, how has that affected the infection rate? Well, we don't know it initially, and we don't have any data on change. And number three, there is no data that says who's getting infected and how are they getting infected. We have not flattened the curve. We have bent the curve, but we are at a plateau of hospitalizations and certainly deaths. And the only way to go from that is up. So as the reopening occurs, we're not flattening. We're not on a decline. We're going to go on an incline. And with no clear data about how those choices are going to be made to ratchet it back.
But what about the issue that we can't shelter in place forever? It's just untenable. And the economy, as we are seeing numbers today, we're in Great Depression territory. So what do you think should be happening, given what you just said, that we don't have information on these three metrics, and yet we just can't stay sheltering in place forever? Where's the balance?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we can get the data. The data is available. We just haven't focused on that and those important questions in collecting that data. Number two, and it's a fundamental question, is it more important public health or the economy? What the governor said initially, and I still believe is his desire, is that public health should be first. Have the economic impacts been substantial? Absolutely. They've been horrible. But we can still help people with food and shelter. We can help them in the future with employment. You cannot take back somebody who has died, and the death rate is high. This is a very dangerous virus where most of the people, or a lot of people that walk around with it, don't even know they have it, so they can continue to spread it. And I think public health should be the driver, and we have to do everything we can to help people during this very difficult economic time.
And are you proposing any kind of action in Sacramento right now on this?
Well, the governor is moving quickly to reopen, so we're all watching this together. I appreciate the great leadership of Assemblywoman Pam Lager, who has been engaged and informed and contributing to the conversation about these choices. But for the most part, the governor's in charge, along with the public health officers for each of the counties. And so our role has been to be a reviewer of decisions that they're making and a contributor to what we think is constructive steps to try to do this better. And that's what I think we're both trying to do in this conversation with you.
Okay, great. State Senator Steve Glaser, Assemblywoman Sydney Kumlager, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, how to get people to get back on buses and trains.
So if we can afford it, one way to provide some distance would be to run more service more frequently, and that way people wouldn't be as concentrated in the vehicles.
Will public transportation survive coronavirus, and why is everyone riding bikes now? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. There are thousands of ways coronavirus has changed our lives. Take transportation. Most of us aren't driving as much. We're not taking public transit as much either. In LA, ridership on trains and buses has dropped around 65%. They have reduced service, closed entrances to stations, started sanitizing vehicles and public spaces a lot more. Once this is all over, will the riders come back? And what will public transportation look like? We're going to ask James Moore these questions and more. He's an engineering professor at USC who studies public transportation. Hi.
Hi there.
Well, you not only study it, you use public transportation. How much were you using it before this all started?
No, I used it 7 times a week, basically. I live downtown. I work at University of Southern California. So,
right.
Transit's been a real asset to me.
And now?
Well, I stepped off the train in mid-March. I noticed that I was the only person on the train that appeared to be employed, who appeared to have a home, and they were using the train primarily for shelter. And I was tempted to stick it out because it's frankly convenient for me. But I decided it wasn't worth the risk since I really didn't understand the disease well enough.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be a risk to them or to myself.
So I guess a lot of people who have the choice are making that same decision. And what does that mean for public transportation now? As we said, ridership is down a lot. So I guess the revenues are down a lot. What is this going to mean going forward?
Well, we look at transit and it looks a bit like a business. It's a service. You pay a fare. The service is delivered. But the truth of the matter is that most of the revenues in transit nationally, and in particularly in Los Angeles, don't really have much to do with the fare box to begin with. So most of the revenues are sales tax revenues. Those will drop going forward. So that's where the real hit for transit will be, not the ridership. The fact that, let's see, you said 65% of the ridership was gone or 65% was still there. I'd forgotten the number you gave us at the opening.
Gone.
All right, so if we compare that to BART, BART is 92% gone. New York, 87% gone. The fact that we lost only 65% of the ridership in LA, it's a testament, I think, to the fact of how important transit is to the low-income households it's serving and how many low-income households we have. So that number, says, as dramatic as it is, that number says to me that transit in Los Angeles really is a very essential service for us.
And how do we provide a service that ensures people who ride public transit are safe from disease?
I wish I knew, frankly, exactly how to do that. You know, I'm not a medical professional, but the literature on masks is pretty clear. I mean, I have typically worn a mask on transit. That was even before the pandemic, but it afforded some protection to me, but what really struck me was that it protected others. And so if we're conscious and careful and thoughtful, really intentional about what we're doing, we can ride transit and be relatively safe. So then I think the question becomes, will the riders be relatively intentional and thoughtful? Certainly the constant cleaning helps. I would say that if we had more service rather than less, then densities on the vehicles would be even lower. So if we can afford it, one way to provide some, and I still don't understand the word social distancing, let's just call it distance. One way to provide some distance would be to run more service more frequently, and that way people wouldn't be as concentrated in the vehicles. Certainly I'm impressed with what MTA has tried to do so far.
But because of budget cuts, they're gonna have to reduce service. Right.
Well, in the short term, we're in reasonably good shape. The CARES Act really effectively tripled the federal funding for transit agencies in this category in 2020. So that's not a long-term solution. The CARES Act is an emergency measure. But in the near term, until we've got a vaccine in place, transit agencies, by and large, will have the means to focus on delivering service.
Okay, so more vehicles, more buses, more trains. How else would you redesign a public transit system for a post-COVID world?
How much authority have I got?
Let's say you are the transit czar of the world, or at least of LA. If you could wave your magic wand, how would you change it?
Well, I probably would stop, this will be controversial, but I'd stop building trains to begin with. We've spent $26 billion on LA County's rail transit plan, and total transit ridership has dropped rather precipitously from our 1985 peak. And we've got 20% more people living in Los Angeles County than we did in 1985. And yet it was 85 where we saw peak transit ridership. If we had done nothing at all, transit ridership would probably be higher, because we can't really replace 18,000 bus stops with 110 rail stations. We want to believe that a rail is a solution, but it's really a solution looking for a problem, frankly. It's expensive enough that if you do what LA does and shift resources from bus service to providing rail facilities, you wind up reducing the total opportunity to travel and the total transit ridership. You add rail capacity and rail riders, but you lose more in the way of bus riders.
So you think actually we should focus more on buses than on trains?
You just said it more succinctly than me, yes.
That's my job, because we're out of time. One more thing, just one more thing you would do. So you would add more buses, fewer trains.
One more thing. I would reconfigure the bus lines so that they aren't designed to feed the trains, but rather each other, so that you could accomplish long trips with fewer transfers. LA is the national leader in transfers, and that's not a good thing.
Okay, so double down on bus service, more buses so that more people can take them and they're not as crammed, and just better service all the way around when it comes to bus service. Those are your recommendations. They don't seem that radical to me. They seem pretty practical.
That's good. If they're incremental, if they're not radical, that means they might actually be doable.
Okay, I have now dubbed you LA Transit Czar.
Bless you.
Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Professor James Moore from USC. Well, while a lot fewer people are riding public transit, more are riding bikes. Bike shops across the country have sold out. One of those companies is Linus Bike, right here in Los Angeles. Their founder, Adam McDermott, joins me now. Welcome.
Hi.
So you're out of stock till when?
We're out of stock until early June. We've been out of stock for a couple of weeks now.
Wow. Is that surprising?
It's surprising. I mean, you know, going into this year, I mean, over the last few years, the bicycle industry has actually been in decline. So, you know, we're always placing projections kind of early in the fall for the following spring. And that's like it's a 5-month kind of lead time. And so in no way did we anticipate for this. Sales over the past few years were, you know, each year was a little bit less than the year before. So even going into the year, we had less stock than we would anticipate. And then, of course, the delays in our supply chain because of, well, for one, tariffs having to move factories, and then on top of that, then Chinese New Year, and then going into the COVID virus.
Because most of your products, the supplies to make the bikes, they come from China?
They come from, well, actually, we manufacture in Taiwan now. We moved to Taiwan to circumvent the recent tariffs that have been added to Chinese-made goods. But still, there's a combination, you know, to make a bike is so many vendors, so there will be like a single part that's ordered from China. If that part is delayed, then the entire bike is delayed.
Oh my gosh. And then, of course, COVID delayed it as well.
And then COVID delayed everything, yeah.
And then now you have on the other side a surge in demand. What do you think accounts for that?
You know, it's a question we keep asking ourselves. I mean, I think a big part of it is just people have less to do. there isn't the lunch with friends or the soccer game with their kids or yoga or Zumba classes. So there's just, besides home and going for a walk or riding a bike, there just isn't much.
And plus, there are fewer cars on the road, so it is safer.
It's much more enjoyable to ride right now. Yeah, there's fewer cars and there's just like less aggression on the road.
Really? I don't know if I'd go that far. I think whenever I'm on the road driving, I feel like everyone's driving too fast. But anyway, for whatever reason, there are more cyclists out there. What is it? First-time buyers? Is it people who have been cycling for a while and are digging out their bikes or wanting to upgrade? Who's buying bikes now?
It's primarily people who are recreational, kind of casual riders. It's bikes that are under $1,000, although we do see a lot of e-bikes, but it's kind of those two ends. It's not the mountain biker or the road bike. Those people ride anyways, whether it's raining or shining or if there's a pandemic or not, you know, they existed. It's really the person who's new to cycling or hasn't ridden a bike in a long time, or is dusting off their bike and finding it's not usable and needs to get a new one.
Hmm. So this is all good news for you, right? Eventually, once you get your supply chain up and running faster.
Yeah. Once we get caught up, it's great. It's really encouraging. You know, a lot of bike stores, you know, over the past few years have been closing. So it's great to see people kind of having renewed interest in cycling. And we see this, we're a brand, but we see this translating all the way to the stores that we sell to. They can't keep stock of bikes, that they have lines of people outside their stores.
Do you think it's going to last? Like once we start coming out and driving more, do you think people are still going to bike this much?
I don't know. You know, that's the big question. I think, you know, as I said earlier, I think there's just less choice in our lives now of things that we can do. And we had so much choice, you know, especially with the economy booming and everyone working. It was like you could go to a fancy gym or you could go to any kind of like workout class, or there's restaurants and entertainment. There's just so much. And now all those choices have been reduced. So I think demand will continue. And I think maybe not at the level that it is right now, but I do think it will continue. I also think a lot of people who rely on public transportation are now opting to ride a bike or something similar. The hope that there is some kind of cultural shift and people will ride more and replace some of the small car trips that they were taking, you know, as you see in Europe and some other kind of more cycling-centric countries.
Yeah. Well, it's ironic that it took a pandemic to get people to do this, because activists have been agitating for years to have more people on bikes and get the cars, you know, share the roads with the cars and for LA to become a more bike friendly city. So I guess it took a pandemic to make that happen.
It's interesting to me that like when there's a crisis like this, there's kind of like a return to like all these kind of like analog, kind of homey pursuits, you know, like there's people are riding bikes and they're just kind of going for a ride with their families. We see that. We have like people are mending socks and baking bread. It's like Little House on the Prairie, you know, in a way.
Yeah, it's kind of nice.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Adam McDermott, founder of the LA bike store Linus Bikes. Coming up, the case against Russell Simmons, hip-hop mogul and accused rapist. A new movie looks into the sexual assault and harassment allegations against him, and a warning, there is some graphic language coming up. All that is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Me Too movement has ended careers and landed men in prison. But when the accuser is a Black woman, her accusations often don't have the same impact. That's the argument put forward in the documentary On the Record. It looks at the multiple accusations against Russell Simmons, hip-hop mogul and co-founder of Def Jam Records.
What is missing from Me Too? It's difficult for me to say. But I don't think it's a coincidence that most of the women who have come forward in Hollywood have been white women. I don't think it's a coincidence that they are generally quite successful. If we look at the earning power of people in America, for example, at the very top are white men, and at the very bottom are women of color. And that is something that I think is necessary to look at when we are talking about who gets to come forward and give their own stories about surviving sexual abuse or sexual assault.
That's a clip from On the Record. The movie is told mostly through the eyes of Drew Dixon. She made her way up the ladder at Def Jam, working with some of the biggest names in hip-hop, like Mary J. Blige and Method Man. But Drew Dixon says her life was changed after she was allegedly raped by Russell Simmons back in 1995. She's one of more than a dozen women who have publicly accused him. Several of them are featured in the documentary. It's currently streaming on HBO Max. Joining me now are the directing and producing team of Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you back. So how many women have publicly come forward to accuse Russell Simmons of sexual assault?
Well, 20 women have publicly come forward to accuse him of either sexual harassment or sexual assault over the last 5 years, I would say.
And you focus mainly on Drew Dixon. You have several other women in the movie, but Drew Dixon is the center of your story. Tell us about her. Who was she when she first met Russell Simmons?
Drew was a rising star in the music business. She had a passion for hip hop and an uncanny ability to sort of cite talent. She quickly, you know, sort of very early on, right? What is it, early 20s, Kirby?
Yeah, her 20s.
Landed a job at Def Jam, which was really, you know, fortuitous, you know, serendipitous. It was sort of her dream job, and then sort of quickly climbed, as you said, climbed the ranks because she was so good at what she did, you know, was really on the forefront of identifying some people who eventually became major players in the industry.
Interesting, because she grew up in Washington, right? She is the daughter of the former mayor there, Sharon Pratt Dixon. So she could have gone into politics or anything along those lines, but she chose music instead. Was that seen as kind of a rebellion of sorts in her family?
No, actually, it was seen as a continuation. And as she says in the movie, and other women do as well, hip hop started as really sort of a political movement. You know, it was really sort of a populist voice, you know, giving voice to a lot of issues that didn't have the ability to break through or have any kind of other forum than mainstream white media. So she saw, oh, my God, this is like this incredible sort of revolutionary moment. And I want to be part of it.
I was just going to say her parents might have seen it a little differently. I think they did expect her to go to law school. I think the family expected a certain path, but, you know, Drew is always sort of carves her own path.
So she gets to Def Jam. She's in her early 20s, and she's in A&R, and she does really well, right? She's, as you say, Amy, able to spot talent and nurture them and bring them forward and make them into successful acts?
Oh, phenomenally well. I think it was within, you know, like, one of her early projects was pulling together a record using a wide array of talent that she had to sort of cull together, identify, and get them to sort of produce a song for the album. And then the album went, what did it, Kirby? It went platinum. He fact checks me. It won a Grammy. It became huge. And it was sort of, you know, that was an amazing feat. As the film documents, not only did she do that, but she did a lot of other kind of really remarkable things very early on in her career that made, you know, quite an impression on everyone at Def Jam and everyone in the industry, honestly.
But Russell Simmons has another idea. He is attracted to her, and by her telling, he repeatedly harasses her in the workplace and made it difficult for her to do her job.
I prefer for people to tell their own stories, but as she says in the film, yes, that she started experiencing this type of sort of ongoing harassment and, you know, did what a lot of women at the time did, was just try and figure out how to manage it, you know, so that she could keep doing the work that she so wanted to do and was so good at doing.
And then comes the night that changed her life, where she is invited into his apartment. And she says that he raped her. She also talks about blacking out. Did she say at all that he may have drugged her or anything like that? Does she remember anything along those lines? Or was it simply a matter of being emotionally overwhelmed by what happened.
She's never made any claim to that effect. So, and you see this among survivors. I mean, people who are assaulted or raped. This is not uncommon that they black out because it's so unexpected, so violent, such a violent experience that this is not an uncommon experience.
So I want to play a clip of tape from your movie of her talking about the difficulty in coming forward if you're a black woman trying to expose sexual misconduct in the workplace. Here she is, Drew Dixon.
I remember my senior year at Stanford watching the Anita Hill hearings.
Professor, do you swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth to help you God?
I do.
He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films involving such matters as women having sex with animals and films showing group sex or rape scenes.
I was like, well, that didn't go very well for her. He's in the Supreme Court now.
So that was right around the time, right, that she was assaulted by Russell Simmons.
It was somewhat later, right? It was several years later. Yeah, but she had recently, kind of lived through that, seen what had happened to Anita Hill. And I think that, you know, became a real lesson to her that if there's an issue of power and a black woman coming forward, she's really putting herself at risk of taking on a powerful person and will very likely be attacked and not believed.
Mm-hmm. So she decides to leave Def Jam because she can't do her job anymore effectively after that.
Yeah, because she's working very closely with Russell Simmons, and it's just an impossible experience. I mean, she's, you know, in fear of this man. I mean, she had tried to deal with his harassment, you know, pretend that he really didn't mean it, accept his apology, consider he was just being a puppy dog, but once, you know, that evening happened, she was no longer able to even be around him. And it had devastated her, and it certainly devastated her associates with him. And she left Def Jam.
And he has maintained that he is innocent of any coercion, that he did not sexually assault any of his accusers. And what has he said specifically about Drew?
I don't think he said a lot. I mean, again, 20 women have come forward and accused him. And we know that people who assault often do it again and again. So when you hear that 20 women have come forward, it's very hard not to believe those women.
Mm-hmm. But he has never been prosecuted, right? Or there hasn't been an investigation, a criminal investigation opened into any of these allegations that you know of?
I think most of the assaults are past the statute of limitations at this point. Mm-hmm. But there have been some investigations, but for the most part, most have not even gone to the step of even involving the police at all.
Well,
wait, but there have been criminal investigations open in New York and Los Angeles. We do know that. Yes.
Oh, there have. Okay. Right. She didn't talk about this publicly for a very long time. And she says that this and other incidents caused her to actually leave the music industry and cut short her career, a very promising career. When did she decide, okay, I am going to go public with this, and why did she decide to do that?
It was a very, for people that watch the film, we sort of chronicle in real time her grappling with that decision. And, you know, that's what's so interesting or unique about this film, we feel, is it gives you sort of a close-up, intimate portrait. You know, what's interesting about this film is that when we connected with her and started following her, she really had no idea. You know, we said, let us just follow you on your journey. We don't want to influence it or pressure you in any way. You know, we just really want to observe. And that was our agreement. And we said, don't sign a release and we'll all see how this goes. And honestly, she did not know as we were following her if she was going to talk to the New York Times. And then she did not know if she would agree to sign a release and be part of a documentary.
So how did you begin this project? Did you know her and you approached her and said, can we just start filming and see where this goes? How did you begin this movie?
I like to say that our films find us. We don't find our films. We really are true investigative filmmakers. And so we were really making a film on Me Too. And in doing so, we cast a wide net and just started interviewing a whole array of women from different industries. And a remarkable filmmaker, Liz Garbus, who's a friend of ours, called us and said, you know, there's this mom at my school. And we were just talking, and she sort of started telling me that she, you know, was sort of roiled by Me Too because she worked in the music industry and it raised all these memories for her. And I said, well, you know, actually, I know these filmmakers. I can vouch for them implicitly. You know, you're safe with them. Do you want to just talk, have an off the record conversation with Amy? And Drew said, sure. And so we reached out to Drew and we spoke with her. And then I said, you know, we're coming to New York to just do these, just film a whole bunch of interviews. What, how about if we just do an interview and you don't sign a release and we just see how it goes? We had about a week of shooting and we were doing about 5 interviews a day. And I remember after each interview, I would check in with the crew to see what they thought. After Drew finished, I, you know, turned around and looked and 3 of the crew members were sobbing. So I called Kirby and I said, this woman's incredible. I think this was just like a phenomenal interview and she's going on this really interesting journey. Maybe we should stay in touch with her and just see if we can follow her. So that's really how it happened.
Mm. And how long did you spend with her and how long did this whole process take?
2 years at least, right, Kirby? Maybe
yeah,
more?
Nearly 2 years. Nearly
2 years.
Yeah, because it's so interesting. It's such a fly-on-the-wall movie. You really see her as she's reaching out for the first time to talk to the New York Times for that blockbuster story. And then you get her the morning that she looks at the paper when it's published. It's really extraordinary.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that was chilling.
I mean, the fact that she did that by herself, I thought was striking. Like, she wasn't with her husband or any close friend, or she was all by herself reading that, and sort of makes me think of how you are all by yourself when you are in this situation.
Yeah.
During the assault, after the assault, and then trying to decide whether you're going to go forward. It's a very solitary, singular decision that no one else can make for you.
No.
I mean, then you have to live with that. I mean, obviously, you know, she has a lot of support, but it is an experience that, you know, in many ways you go through alone. And it's, you know, what's, I think, so affecting about the film is you see somebody going through the process of deciding to come forward and tell something that they have kept hidden for decades. And then after they come forward, you know, in many ways, so much changes, and in many ways, so much doesn't.
How does she feel now that this movie is out and that her whole story is, and these very intimate moments that you captured are now available for the world to see?
Well, I think she's been gratified by the response it's been getting. You know, I know that Sundance was sort of an extraordinary moment. I mean, we didn't know what to expect. It had been quite an arduous journey getting there. I remember the audience came in for the premiere and they were all seated, and then they brought us in and they brought Drew and Salai Abrams in and Sherry Scherer, the 2 other women in the film, along with these amazing other voices that are in the film, Dr. Joan Morgan, Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, Shanita Hubbard, and Kierna Mayo. And we all walk in and without a word said, the audience leapt to its feet. And we got like a 5-minute standing ovation. And honestly, like everybody was just like thunderstruck because we hadn't said a word. The film hadn't screened. I've never experienced that or seen that in the history of filmmaking, honestly. You know, we've had really extraordinary openings. You know, from there, people saw the film. And again, thunderous, you know, embrace and, you know, exceptional reviews. So I think that made all these women feel really, really gratified and supported and embraced, you know, and, you know, it was... That's been extremely, you know, fortunate and powerful, you know, and empowering. So that part's been great. But as you know, with all these kind of stories, it's never an easy ride. So this is a new, you know, this is now a wider platform it's going forward on. So there's, you know, an excitement, but there's also, you know, a quiet dread, honestly. You know, your story's going to be out there, and people often can be very unkind and very unkind to women that come forward in this way. So I think it's a mixture of, you know, extreme hope and, you know, trepidation.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming on today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering directed and produced On the Record, currently streaming on HBO Max. And that's it for us here at Press Play. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast. Listen whenever or wherever you want. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever you may get your podcasts. Also, while you're there, sign up for my brand new podcast that I do with Jessica Levinson. It's called The Legal Eagle Files. You can get it at KCRW or, again, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.